Hey, and welcome to FutureThinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova. If you're new to the show and you want to get a list of our favorite books, popular episodes, and to join our community, go to FutureThinkers.org/start. Welcome back to the show. This is part two of our interview with Chris Beasley, author, podcaster, AI startup founder, and healing practitioner who created the Lovelock card deck to help people work with their difficult emotions.
In this episode, we talk about the role of emotional health in society, practicing aspects of getting in touch with the wisdom of our bodies, as well as the relationship of mainstream science with the healing practices like energy work. You can find all the links and show notes at futurethinkers.org/102. Check out our new course in personal evolution. Part one is on cultivating sovereignty and is designed to support you in developing more clarity about your direction and purpose in life, making better decisions, and having more agency to live your life on your own terms.
Part two is on integrating the shadow and is designed to support you in overcoming nihilism and tapping into an inner source of energy, creativity, and wisdom to make meaningful progress towards actualizing your full potential. To learn more, go to courses.futurethinkers.org.
I was thinking about how important it is to slow down in these sort of conflict situations. I don't know if conflict's the right example, but in situations where you find yourself kind of possessed by one of these modes, one of these responses. And it's interesting to me how little we let ourselves slow down. But maybe it's kind of an aspect of the conflict, like you need to be fast in order to appear smart, in order to, you know, win or dominate or whatever, or respond or fix the situation. But I've seen a lot in the conversations that we've been having in our group calls from the course where people are so willing to just sit in silence and think about their answers more, because we've already kind of established this, like, don't try and be smart rule. So no, you know, I think that's kind of ringing in people's heads a little bit, like, don't try and prove how smart you are. So everyone's willing to sit there and think. And I can see the use of that in so many of the situations that we've talked about already. The you know, it's like grandma's old wisdom. If you find yourself frustrated, count to 10. You know, it's funny how simple advice like that tends to be. You know, we roll our eyes because it's like everyone's heard that since they were little, but it tends to be the best.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also making time to feel into it as well. Like, it's not just taking time to think, but it's taking time to feel into what's actually going in my body. Because if you're in that, oh, I want to say something, oh, it's time to look smart, oh, my ego needs to come in and present my avatar in a way that satisfies that ego presentation.
Yeah, you said that really well.
There's no space to feel into what's actually going in my body. You're numb to it, especially if you're habitually numb to it. But even as you start to wake up your emotions, it still takes me sort of, okay, I have to pull that verbal part of myself online to most deeply connect with myself. And it does take time. And I think if we look back at the Quaker religious tradition, they were famous for waiting until they felt like there was a thing that needed to be said and it was inspired. I just have to take a minute to talk about the word inspired. Inspiration and respiration have the same root, and it is about drawing breath. It is about, like, connecting to that source of life. So anyway, just a little throwback to the importance of breath.
And
feeling
and
yourself breathe.
Wasn't it about, like, breathing in the spirit?
I'm not sure, but that sounds...
I thought that was the root of the actual old meaning of inspire and respiration. It's like bringing in the spirit.
Yeah, and we were talking about this before we started recording, which is sort of the aspect of the foundations of science as we know it, both of Newtonian physics and quantum physics, which are, you know, if anything, seem like the most concrete pieces of our materialist worldview. Those scientists were deeply esoteric spiritual people. I mean, God, like, Albert Einstein discovered the laws of relativity because he had a vision quest of himself running alongside a beam of light. It was a completely non-rational discovery inspiration process, as well as Isaac Newton, and you know, everything that we know about gravity, and the foundation of, it just feels like the most concrete science ever. And it, really, he was an alchemist, and that just gets conveniently erased from our textbooks because, oh, he wasted all of his time. Neil deGrasse Tyson's like, it's a disgrace. He wasted his time.
Yeah. Or Niels Bohr. He was, you know, one of the physicists who built the foundation of quantum theory, and he was super spiritual and doing a lot of his work, or, you know, coming up with a lot of his insights in altered states.
Mm-hmm. Carl Jung.
Yeah, of course, Carl Jung.
That's obvious, though. But,
yeah.
And more psychology related. But still, like, I mean, so much of what he discovered was going through that explorative kind of spirit journey.
Mm-hmm.
There's another one. I think it was, I'm trying to recall the theory that this guy invented. It was either E8 or it might be something else. When I remember, I'll post it in the show notes, but it's this guy who was living in his van by the beach, a quantum physicist, and came up with this sort of geometric theory of everything, of all reality. And it just seems like another one of these kind of examples. It's actually a fascinating talk that he I think he did a TED talk, so guys, check it out.
I think it was the E8 lattice.
Yeah, E8 lattice. That sounds right. Yeah, fascinating theory. I can't explain it, so I won't.
And I think there's a lot of problems with sort of the gold standards of evidence that we have, that we've used in terms of, you know, we have to have a randomized controlled trial to prove that a methodology works, but it's incredibly political to get a study funded, right? So if you type in Prozac, you can find 15,000 studies on Prozac, but if you try to get a study on neurofeedback funded, it's incredibly difficult, even a single study. So Bessel van der Kolk, who wrote the number one selling book in psychiatry and has done multiple National Institutes of Mental Health studies, he did the very first study on Prozac, actually. I was at his workshop a few months ago, and he just went on a tirade about how political science is. And I can't imagine a better set of credentials than Dr. Bessel van der Kolk has. His book outsells the DSM-5.
Wow.
And he's as distinguished of a researcher as you can possibly get. And he's had studies that got 5-star evidentiary findings from the committees, but were still rejected because these journals are funded by the drug industry. And if you show that you can teach somebody how to tap their acupressure meridians and regulate themselves, and they don't need a pill to do that, then they literally get these studies kicked out of the journal. So there's so many gates at which money and power and influence are massively skewing what we even can discuss as truth, because we have the standard that it has to be shown in multiple randomly controlled trials that something is beneficial. We have a real circularity of truth problem here. And, you know, it really gets at people's core beliefs, and people get real upset even talking about this. But I don't know how you can not acknowledge that science is political, and what the front lines of truth are even about is something that's not level. This is not a level playing field. And there are the people who write the checks for these studies and the people who decide what gets published in what journal have very strong biases.
And I think that's part of the reason why it's so important for us to actually go and experiment ourselves to see what works with these different kinds of techniques. Because, you know, if we're just trusting traditional doctors or traditional medical journals, we're not going to get all the information.
That's right.
I wonder if there's an opportunity for crowdfunded scientific study.
Some of them cost so much
Yeah.
that it's quite difficult.
Yeah.
There is a platform that is attempting to do that, and I evaluated that at one point as a potential funding source because I was looking at pulling together a lab that was bringing together really an integrative place for psychologists and all energy medicine and technologists to all come together to build technology with the purpose of creating greater well-being. But that stuff needs to be funded, and I had a potential grant maker for like 300 to 500,000, but you can't, that's, I mean, just the tiniest little drop in a bucket. You're going to hire a staff. You need to have a 2-year working budget, minimum of like $2 million. So I was looking at this funding landscape problem, and I found a crowdfunded platform for science, and it was pulling in like 6,000, 11,000. It just wasn't, it wasn't even remotely enough to do the kind of scale that would be considered. And the other thing that's interesting is that there's this front lines of truth called Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. And if you look at some of the talk pages for something like neurofeedback or craniosacral therapy or some of these things that I personally have experienced and known lots of people who have experienced and had good results with, and the leading experts in the field who do have all the letters behind their name also recognize, many of those therapies are listed as pseudoscience. And when I look at the talk pages, they'll be like, yeah, we see that there was a study, like some brave person got a study on that thing, but it didn't get published in a journal that the Wikipedia editors consider to be, you know, legitimate. But it's this circularity, like if you just don't like the things that that journal tends to publish about, then you just completely blacklist that journal because that journal talks about energy medicine and you don't think energy medicine is real. And so you just, nope, we just reject everything that that journal publishes. And, you know, I was like, you're playing by the rules, you're getting studies funded and you're adhering to the standards of evidence, but it's still not considered right because you've just decided that you don't like that whole journal. It's a real problem. So I think you're right, Yuvi, that we have to follow our own intuition. We have to feel into our own body. We have to trust our senses. We have to know that if something is making us better, it is making us better, and it doesn't really matter why, and that's enough.
Yeah, and also learning discernment, because there are people who are hacks or, you know, overcharge for whatever they're doing. And maybe it's just some sort of version of placebo. And there's a technique that a person can learn in just a few sessions to do it on their own rather than go to some practitioner and pay thousands of dollars every time. So it, a lot of it just comes back to sovereignty, you know, like sovereign knowledge of yourself, but also sovereign, sovereign knowledge of yourself and sovereign knowledge of the world.
Yeah. And trusting that word of mouth really matters. This is how we used to, you know, if you imagine a world in which we lived in much smaller communities and you knew everybody that you grew up with because you grew up with the same 250 people, you didn't have a trust problem. You knew whether you could trust people or not. You'd be like, this person consistently shows up and I can't rely on that person. And that's not going to be my medicine person. But there's also this aspect of if another tribe comes and sends emissaries, you trust your reaction to the person. You trust whether you get a good read and you can develop that intuition by being like, I don't know. I met this person and I like what they're talking about, but I kind of get there's this like little niggling part of me that feels like something is sideways. And you talk to somebody else who has also met that person or has worked with that person ideally. And you can be like, this is kind of, and that person will be like, yeah, I worked with them and it was great and you should try it. And you know that person. This is what we try to sort of strap together with something like Yelp ratings at scale on humanity. You know, we think that we have to have this humanity scale problem of how are we going to rate healers, and then we're going to get into accreditation and these big systems of trust that we've sort of delegated out to an accrediting authority. But it turns out talking to your friend who knows you and knows the practitioner is still something that we very much have access to. And once you tap into kind of the community of people who are healing themselves and doing this work, they know you, they know the people they've worked with and had good results with. That is far more powerful than something that's published in a journal. So don't discount that. And it's almost like gossip. We have to talk to person. We have to say, I kind of think this is a little bit sideways and shady, and I got a weird feeling. Do you also get a weird feeling? It's called gossip. It's really helpful. It's the way that we do trust when there's no authority. It's how we actually find our sovereignty, is not externalizing that authority out to a journal or, you know, anybody else.
I really agree with that. And I think that some of the stuff that kind of goes under the radar, the really shady stuff, also goes under the radar because we don't trust our intuition. And because we don't, like, when you hear something about someone, a practitioner, that's like really negative, and then you hear another person talk about it that's really negative, but you're like, well, I have no proof, so I'm going to discount it. No, how about take that as, this is valid information. This is somebody's firsthand experience. It matters.
Right.
Yeah.
It's funny because connecting to the body is the least frou-frou shit. Like, there's nothing realer.
Mm-hmm. I know. Like, that's such a good point.
If you think these fucking soft skills are soft, this is the hardest motherfucking shit you've ever done in your whole life. There's no question. Yeah. There ain't nothing soft about this shit.
If you think about it, like, your body is so much older, evolutionary speaking, than the rational part of your mind. Like, what is it? 300,000 years old? I might be fucking up with the zeros, but it's very, very new. Like, the prefrontal cortex is extremely new and extremely inefficient as far as its processing capacity. And the unconscious mind is really fucking old and much, much faster, and it's able to process, like, so many more pieces of data at the same time. And yet people are like, ugh, unconscious? No.
Well, and yeah, I want to, now that I'm sort of back, I'm back from Canada, I want to get in on the weekly calls for sure. But I love doing some exercises to help people understand that their conscious mind doesn't even have the ability to inspect everything that's in the unconscious mind. So I gave a talk at GitHub. I'm like, okay, we're going to do a demonstration. I'm going to show you that your body knows how to do things that your conscious mind doesn't know shit about and actively has the wrong information about. So what I have everybody do is put their hands out like you have a steering wheel. And you guys can do this if you want.
All right, let's do this.
Okay, so put your arms out. And what I'm going to have you do is I'm going to count down 3, 2, 1. And you're going to show me what it looks like to change lanes when you're driving in a car. Got it?
I don't drive.
Yeah. So, yeah. I have to watch Mike. Okay, so I'm not going to do it with you because that would be cheating. So when I count down 3, 2, 1, change lanes. 3, 2, 1. Okay, you did what literally everybody does except you use your blinker, which is great. So you just drove off the road because you did this. And that's how you execute a turn. So to change lanes, you do this, and you come back to center, and then you go just as far in the other direction, and then you go like yeah. This.
That's so funny. And it's so easy when you're driving. You wouldn't like, duh, and then just go into the ditch. That's so funny.
Exactly. So our conscious mind is sure that it knows how to drive. It's confident that it knows how to change lanes. Does it all the time. Fucking bullshit. Your conscious mind doesn't know anything about how to do anything. Your conscious mind doesn't understand how to walk. Your conscious mind doesn't, like, all of these body-based skills that we have are utterly resistant to inspection by our conscious mind.
You know, as I'm thinking about that, I'm recognizing the importance of the in-the-moment consciousness that is responding to the environment. So there's a feedback loop that doesn't exist in the conscious mind. But that's the only difference between, like, this and then the technique is, like, you're getting that feedback in the moment. The entire conversation makes so much more sense with this metaphor. It's perfect.
I just want to make sure that I am coming to the core of what I have to offer, which is about this somatic. I mean, really, my whole thing is bridging between the intellectual mind and helping people to understand that their body is a safe place to be in, and that they're home, and they belong. They belong to themselves. Maya Angelou says, "I belong everywhere and nowhere." Totally messing up her quote, but that's that's the essence of it. Coming into the safety of being at home in your body, coming into the safety of belonging to yourself, because that's really what sovereignty is. And making, then once you can feel that on one level, catching all of the former sort of child self subroutines that are still running in your brain, catching those selves up to this person that does have agency. Like, I'm the kind of person who can pay my car registration. I'm the kind of person who can have difficult conversations. I'm the kind of person that can feel anger and still be responsible in the way that I communicate. I'm the kind of person that can just go to bed when I'm tired, you know, whatever that thing is for each person. We're all going to have our own different stories. Just giving them the tools. In my practice, I very much love to teach people the tools to heal themselves instead of just teaching them better coping strategies. And that's what a lot of modern talk therapy has been, even almost explicitly stated. Cognitive behavior therapy is teaching you better coping strategies. And that's great. We need better coping strategies. But the work I do is deeper, and it doesn't go on for very long. My instructor only works with people for about 2 months, because she says, you don't need to be facing your shadow that consistently for more than 2 months. It's like, go work on the thing and then be happy. Go live your life. You can come back to me in 6 months or a year and we'll work through another layer of the onion. But you're not going to show up with an EFT practitioner, which is what I do, as well as energy work that pulls out the trauma. And we're not going to show up and do that every week. It doesn't make any sense. I'd much rather have super deep sessions, and I'm doing those, some of those assisted by plant medicines. Now that ketamine inhalers for depression are legal, some of my clients have some of those, and using that stuff and having me to guide those journeys and go really deep. But I get really bored. I don't want to see somebody, if I have a patient that's coming back and talking to me 8 years later about the same boyfriend girlfriend dynamics and they're still stuck in the same loops, that's never going to happen. If I get to the end of 2 or 3 months with somebody and they're still stuck in the same loops, I'm going to refer them out to another practitioner. So it's a very different way of dealing with it and getting to the root causes.
Yeah. Yeah. I just wanted to say that I love that, and I'm like 100% agree with that approach, because I think that any system that creates dependency rather than sovereignty for the person is some sort of a scam. Like, there's something wrong with it, because the point is to create healing that enables the person to then take the next step on their own and be able to go out there and be their own person and feel more at home in their body.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the relationship that you have with the therapist that makes space for that work, that therapist is not your friend. In fact, most therapists won't work with you if you are connected to them socially. If they see you on the street, they won't walk up to you and have a conversation with you. And I think we need that distance to do that kind of work, but that's not how healing the root causes necessarily needs to be. I think a lot of healing the shame in the deepest, deepest level is being seen by somebody in your life who is part of your community. Like, the shamans and medicine people of old were, you know, your cousin's grandma. You know, they might put on a mask to sort of separate themselves and provide that ability to step into an altered state with someone that is psychologically on a different plane so that you're not that's my grandma that changed my poopy diapers. Now they've put on a mask and they've sort of ascended into a different role to pull at the, you know, the highest part of themselves and not even show that ego presentation, but totally become a different mask, a different self. But I'm really interested in this, in the distinction between Indigenous and Aboriginal healing techniques and how shockingly different that is from modern psychology, where they put up these very clinical boundaries to sort of separate you from your therapist. Your therapist is never going to get pissed off at you and be like, you need to clean this shit up. You did something that pissed me off. I'm going to be right here cheering you on while you do it. Like, I've never seen a therapist do that. And it's not considered part of their scope of practice. And I'm not even saying that's a bad thing, but I'm just observing how different that energy is. Because I was just at Sundance in Calgary, in Alberta, Canada. And yeah, it's a super intense thing. And you're there, and you're there with your family, you're there with your community, you're there with your people, and they are healing you. And there is none of that clinical separation. You're in the mud, literally together. And those grandmas are going to straighten your shit out. They're going to tell you, like, that thing you did pissed me off, and I love you, and you need to clean that shit up.
Yeah.
And I love that energy.
I totally agree. And that something reminds me of the way that the old Zen masters used to teach their students, and they had this little stick that they would whack them with if they did something really egoic or really stupid. And now, of course, that's considered, oh, it's abusive. We would never tolerate that. But I can totally see value in that, because sometimes people just need to be smacked out of their stupidity. And like, it doesn't create injury, you know, it's just like a little whack, right. Like, oh, what's happening? Oh, yeah, that's right. I was being stupid. Duh.
Yeah. And it is being made meaningful to the body. Yes. I'm certainly not a fan of corporal punishment, but there is a way in which, again, if they like smacked you and it like physically hurt, but it's more energetically it hurts. Mm. It's more like socially it hurts. It's more like, oh, God, I was just seen doing something dumb, and that's way, it's not about the pain, and it shouldn't be painful because that would be abusive, but mm-hmm. But it, the energetic, like, whoop. Stop that shit.
yeah. I think that bringing some of these older techniques into the modern world can be really useful, but I can't, like, I haven't figured out a way how to properly fit it into society. And I wonder if the changes that are happening in the world now are going to allow for that naturally. Because what I've noticed is that it seems the kind of super globalized world is fragmenting again into smaller communities. And maybe that's healthy, you know? Because for the last, I don't know, 50 years or something, people were so not communal, especially in developed countries. And now it seems to be returning to that kind of more communal state.
We were sold this bill of goods called the American Dream, with the idea of houses, these little atomic families in atomic houses. And we built our zoning codes on it. It's now literally almost impossible to even get a bank loan to build a house that isn't a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house. You know, I want to live in an intentional community, and I'm sitting in a house right now that has 10 adults willingly living together, not even so much, although the financial part of it is significant. In the Bay Area, it's much cheaper for 10 people to live in a giant house than it is for us all to have our own $3,000 per month, you know, 1-bedroom loft studio situation. Rather, we're in like a $1,000 a month, 10-bedroom big house. So the financial part of it is there. But for me, my real motivation is that I like living with people. And I feel much healthier. And I even think it's better for introverts, because all I have to do to engage with people is to walk out my bedroom door. And as soon as I want to be by myself, I can go shut my door. I have my own sovereign space, but it's sort of like layers of engagement between me and the public world. Instead of, I lived in a one bedroom apartment by myself, and that's when I fell into the only depressive episode I've ever had in my life. It's you walk out your door and you're in public. But if you live in these intentional communities or co-housing, you have shades of intimacy, and you can decide at any point where on that spectrum you want to be. And I think that's historically how we have lived. And I think it's just a much healthier way of being. And yet all of our zoning codes and our built infrastructure of all the buildings that are around us are around this post-war idea or ideal of the American dream. And I think it's the American nightmare. It's not working out so well. Yeah. And unfortunately, we've exported that most of the way around the globe, and it's had the exact same effect in all of those places as well.
Yeah. And then we wonder why there's this epidemic of mental illness and repression, and people are not able to deal with so many things because we were not meant to be isolated. Like for a whole human history, we lived in tribes and we gave each other emotional support and we had people to talk to and interact with every day. And now people are so isolated. It's like, it's no wonder that they're sick.
And we don't even touch each other in American, you know, westernized culture. If you don't have a romantic partner and you don't have enough money to pay somebody to massage you, you probably haven't been touched for more than 30 seconds. Yeah. In weeks, months, years.
Yeah, and people really don't realize how much touch we need.
Mm-hmm. And then we put that unmet need for intimacy solely on our romantic partner, and that creates, even if you do have a romantic partner, that like grasping for the touch can become a really bad dynamic because, you know, sometimes in our romantic partnerships, we have really good solid touch connection, but there's a whole snarl of like, oh, I can't touch you because I'm not in the mood for sex. And if I touch you, then that's going to open up the door and you're going to think that it's, and then I have to tell you no, and I don't really have the emotional space to set that boundary. And so I'm just not going to touch you. It just causes this huge snarl, and it's unfair for us to really put the full burden of touch and emotional regulation on our romantic partner, whether you're a man or a woman.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. It's all of these different cascading problems in our society that have landed us in the state that we are. If we look at how individuals are and the average emotional health of a modern individual, how poor it is.
Yeah.
It's like all of these different things have cascaded to make that happen, which makes it so much more difficult to fix it, because if you fix one thing, there's still like a million other things pushing on it.
But I really want to call back to my favorite of your episodes, Daniel Schmachtenberger's Generators of Existential Risk, where he talks about this phase in which, you know, the caterpillar has eaten so much and eaten so much and eaten so much in its growth curve. And then we can change and we have to change. The caterpillar can change and it has to change. So I feel like we are in the meltdown to the goo. And I feel like the listeners to this podcast are part of the imaginal cells, which are that contain the pattern for what we are transforming into. That's what gives me hope.
Yeah, definitely. I fully agree with you. And I think that's a beautiful place to wrap this up. That as difficult as all of this seems, there's always a light at the end of the tunnel. And in order to create something new, a lot of the time, something old needs to break down. So I think that's just a normal part of this transition.
Totally agree.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been really insightful. And I think our listeners will love the practical applications of getting in touch with their body, because we get this question all the time. Like, mm-hmm. people are really stuck in their heads. So I think this will be a nice breath of fresh air.
Where can people find you?
So I have a podcast called Hack Reality, H-A-C-K Reality. And I also, that one is about healing. And it's really a podcast about the body for people stuck in their mind. And I have a podcast on Hacker Noon, which is about the technology aspect of that. How do we make humane technology? And if you want to draw a card in my Oracle deck about emotional intelligence, you can go to chrisbeasley.com, C-R-I-S-B-E-A-S-L-E-Y.com.
Cool. Thanks.
Cool. This Thanks so much.
Why can you be?
All right. That was part two of our interview with Chris Beasley. To get all the links and show notes for this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/102. And you can check out part one of this interview at the same link. And if you want to stay up to date with our latest episodes, blog posts, or news from Future Thinkers, join our mailing list at futurethinkers.org/mailing-list. To meet like-minded people, join our Future Thinkers Discord community. Go to futurethinkers.org/discord.
Check out our new course in personal evolution. Part one is on cultivating sovereignty and is designed to support you in developing more clarity about your direction and purpose in life, making better decisions, and having more agency to live your life on your own terms.
Part two is on integrating the shadow and is designed to support you in overcoming nihilism and tapping into your inner source of energy, creativity, and wisdom to make meaningful progress towards actualizing your full potential. To learn more, go to courses.futurethinkers.org. Don't forget to subscribe and hit the bell icon to get notified of new videos. You can also follow us on social media to stay connected. If you'd like to get a t-shirt like the new Make America Think Again, go to futurethinkers.org/store. If you like what we do and you want to help us make more podcasts and videos, consider donating or becoming a patron at futurethinkers.org/support. Also visit our sponsor Qualia and use the coupon code FUTURE to get 10% off your purchase.